How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope everyone is doing well, staying safe, wearing masks. And this is an all Boston, all the time show tonight. This is fun. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Lisa Gardner, who is a remarkably prolific writer of crime, serial crime, bizarre criminal minds like people. She's had written over 20 very successful novels, and she's got one out now called Before She Disappeared, which I picked up about a week ago and couldn't put down until I had finished it. Tonight, we've got Claude Jennings doing all the important work. Jamie McIntyre's come back. Thank you, Jamie. And we are joined by Lydia McOsker, who comes to us from Brookline Booksmith. And that is a bookstore, in an independent bookstore in Boston, recommended to us by one of our favorite Chatter listeners, Eric Londrigan. I have been hearing from friends and relatives and everybody, you need to do more with independent bookstores. Boston is a big hub for a lot of listeners, and Eric gets the thanks for recommending Brookline Booksmith. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And we discussed before the show that Lydia did not watch the Super Bowl last night, not a big Super Bowl fan. But we do have to start with that. We just have to start with that. And David's happy that he's not here tonight. We don't make him talk about sports for 20 minutes. Jamie, I know you watched.
I watched most of it. I missed the streaker at 5 minutes left in the game.
But you've heard the play-by-play of the streaker.
I did, yes.
Spectacular.
Yeah. He's wearing a bra. He's taking his pants up. Pull your pants up, man. No, yeah. I don't. So apparently, my wife Roberta didn't see it either, and she was actually awake during that time. I might not have been totally awake then.
I thought that was a thing. You're a TV person. Maybe Claude knows, but I thought it was a thing where they try very hard. If streakers and crazy people get
right
on, they try not to show them.
I think it wasn't seen by
right
the
because then that encourages the next
audience
one. Yeah.
Yeah, all you were actually able to see was him running through the background, and then they quickly panned the camera, and they tried very hard not to show him, but they showed video of players looking at him and looking kind of confused and just kind of over the whole thing. So you knew what was going on. You saw him.
And I heard he slid in at the 1 yard line. If you're that
yes
far,
he did,
in your bra and your pants falling down, why do you not go across the goal line?
He had some sort of, you know, like monotard or something that was fluorescent color and some shorts over that. And then apparently at some point he lost the shorts. It reminded me of that outfit that Borat was wearing.
Yes, that's what I was thinking
in the
of
movie. Yes. Anyway, but enough about that. The game itself, of course, my wife Roberta said she couldn't root for the Buccaneers. Because of Tom Brady, even though she's from Florida and her brother-in-law was her brother is a big Buccaneers fan. So then she said she would root for them. But then I secretly kept seeing her grunting and groaning every time Kansas City would make a mistake. And, you know, excuse me, you know, you win some and you lose some. But in this case, Kansas City, they didn't just not win the game. They actually lost the game.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a case where every time something went wrong for Tampa Bay, a penalty would correct it and give them another chance. And every time something went right for Kansas City, a penalty would nullify it. And it was just, you could see. And that's one of the things, sometimes you watch these games and there's this dynamic where one team just can't get a break.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when they kick the ball, it bounces the other way. And then when the, you know, and you could see the way it was going and you kept thinking, well, you know, it's early in the game. It, you know, these are great teams.
That clock moved fast.
But
they looked snake bit from the beginning. Patrick Mahomes, who's fabulous. And if anybody can catch up to Tom Brady's record of 10 Super Bowls and 7 wins, maybe Patrick Mahomes can. He was beleaguered. He was beleaguered every time he looked up. He'd have those guys in his face harassing him. The things he could do, the athleticism of that guy, he'd be falling down and throw the ball into the end zone. He hit a couple of the guys in the face mask, but still,
right. Yeah,
his
and then
ability,
the receiver would drop it, which is
yeah
the other
well,
big
because they saw their quarterback falling down. It didn't occur to them that he would throw the ball.
So, of course, Tom Brady to Gronk
the best
was so you yes know and it's so typical that you're watching the game in the first quarter, and one of the announcers, I forget which one it was, says, and you know, Tom Brady has never had a first quarter touchdown in any of his previous Super Bowl appearances.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, boom.
Yeah, he heard it.
Yeah.
He heard it. We were talking before the show about just how ruthlessly efficient he was. Just it just looked like, I mean, he had the demeanor, the composure of somebody who's just going down to mail a letter in the mailbox, right? It didn't seem like it was particularly hard. He wasn't breaking a sweat. He just looked like another day in the park. He's remarkable. There was a great, the best Brady quote ever. It was a tweet I saw last night, and this was, he does a regular radio appearance on WEEI. Is that
It's in Boston.
Lydia, we can ask you, sports radio in Boston. And they were asking about when he's going to retire and these kinds of things. This was in 2014. So this was 6 years ago, five Super Bowls ago. He says he's being asked about retirement. He goes, when I suck, I'll retire. But I don't plan on sucking for a long time. Just so great. That's like Ovi Ovechkin.
You know, on Twitter, lots of people were having fun with the result of the game, complaining about how, you know, Kansas City was up 3-0, and then they went to refresh their drink, and suddenly these points just appeared out of nowhere. Somebody tweeted, you know, we shouldn't be so quick to grant the trophy to the Buccaneers because the Kansas City Chiefs have every right to exhaust every legal avenue in challenging the result of the game.
It
too
was
early
good.
To say that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won.
Go to the courts. It was fun. I watched from beginning to end, and I just, as I say all the time, I'm in awe of Tom Brady, what he does, how he does it. And you don't find people who on background or any grounds are trashing the guy on this team, you know, brand new to the team. He wants everybody to look good. He wants everybody to do well. He's just, he's a god, greatest of all time. Okay. Speaking of greatest of all time. Okay. Lydia, you're the book person. Have you ever read any of Simon Winchester's books like Krakatoa?
I have not.
Professor and the Madman, which turned into a great movie. So we had Simon Winchester on, is that last week, Claude? It was just last week?
Yes, it was.
We had him on last week. Absolutely brilliant. He started with a great poem. Then he has a great recipe for a drink, the Rocky Mountain Sneezer. Fabulous stories, terrific book. We've gotten tons of emails about him. And here's one of my favorites. This is from Sue. I don't know where Sue is from, but she says, I have no idea how I found your podcast, but I'm so happy that I did. My guess is that I was searching for all things literary on Stitcher. Who knew? When I got home from today's walk, I emailed the link to three friends. Thank you, Sue. We've talked about our love of books that includes maps. Simon Winchester is brilliant at maps. Next, I will send it to my 87-year-old mother. I'm absolutely gobsmacked by the podcast episode featuring Simon Winchester. Several of the emails that came in about Simon Winchester used the word gobsmack, which is terrific. I laughed aloud at least a half dozen times. The podcast was entertaining, informative, thoroughly enjoyable. My mom lives in Western Mass. Someday I hope to be able to visit her. I sure would love to have a couple of cocktails with Simon Winchester. There were quite a few of those in the emails as well, too. I would hope that he would do all the talking. He was absolutely spectacular. Thank you, Sue. Love that one. He was terrific. Absolutely terrific. And we could have gone on all night with him because he can talk about maps. He can talk about drinks. He can talk about poetry. He could talk about blowing up the lab when he was in high school. Absolutely brilliant guy. And if you ever have a chance post-pandemic to have him in the store at Brookline Booksmiths, you should do it.
He's one of those people I wish I'd sort of known about before, because you know when you go in these job interviews and they always ask you, like, well, if you only have lunch with three people,
right,
who would it be? And I usually have no idea, but I would definitely include Simon Winchester.
Absolutely. Who would the other two be?
Don't put me on the spot like that.
Go for it. Go for it. It's the pop quiz.
I don't know. I can't answer those questions. Those are the dumbest questions.
Oh, I love those questions. Lydia, if you could have lunch with three authors, which three authors would you like to have lunch with?
Well, I mean, now I'm thinking the ones that can make cocktails. Those are at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, there are so many. Is it the people that I like to read or the ones that have
wherever
really
you want.
Great stories?
Lunch can be long. It could be a full hour. So you better enjoy being with these people.
Well, I would have said Fran Lebowitz, but now that I watch Pretend It's a City, I feel like I pretty
got
much
that.
Heard her whole shtick.
Yeah, okay? Right.
But she is fat. She's a ton of fun to listen to because she's very acerbic, hyper-rational, and doesn't take any prisoners.
Nice. Our kind of person. Okay, so Lydia, let's talk about Brookline Booksmith. highly recommended by several of our Chatter listeners. Give us a little bit about the history of the store, how long it's been around, what was life like before the pandemic?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's located in Brookline, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. And we're actually coming up on our 60th anniversary this year.
Wow.
So it's been around for quite a while. The owner and founder, Marshall Smith, actually just retired a few years ago. It's still in the Smith family. His son has taken over for him. So it's independent. It's, you know, hasn't changed hands or gone up the corporate ladder at all. It's been in the same spot for 60 years. So it's really exciting to sort of be like built into the community the way that we are. It was originally Paperback Booksmith was the name,
right?
Because at the time, people always are fascinated when I tell them, like, paperbacks used to be, the idea of a paperback book was like kind of sleazy, right? And like of ill repute. Like if you were publishing paperback books, you weren't like a literary publisher. And if you were selling them, then there was something a little off about you. You were kind of like wearing trench coats in an alley. But anyway, so that's the line of business that we went into. And it was the founder was like very staunchly of the belief that making books cheaper and more accessible would like democratize reading and make everything more accessible for everyone. And that was kind of his vision and his goal.
Kind of good vision.
And we're no longer, he was well ahead of his time. And obviously we sell all kinds of books now, not just paperbacks. We're Brookline Booksmith rather than Paperback Booksmith. But that kind of philosophy has guided the store for pretty much the entire run of our course.
Yeah. One of the things we've talked about with a lot of the local bookstores down here in the DC area, Pittsburgh Penguin Bookshop, we talked to a few weeks ago, is before the pandemic, you were really a hub in the community. And it was a place people wanted to come and spend time together. Was that true at your place?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people in the neighborhood have kind of grown up with the store. Like they learned to read there as kids, and they're bringing their kids and their grandkids there now. So they're used to being able to walk in the door anytime they want and, you know, see an author or grab a book or, you know, talk to the staff. It's a very kind of physical thing that people have held on to.
Yeah. So how did you pivot during the pandemic? Did you have to shut down completely at first? And then did you have to learn about packing and shipping and things like that you didn't know how to do?
Yes. I mean, we've always done that a little bit, but it was a real crash course in the packing and shipping and also just like online orders. We overhauled our website. We put in this curbside pickup window, which is, I've been just calling it an ice cream window, although it's less exciting because there's no ice cream, but so people can come up and do contactless pickup. We had this long-standing renovation planned. So well before the pandemic began, we had this vision. We got a liquor license. We were going to put in a restaurant. Wow. We were going to have all these like, you know, events with like, you know, like wine tastings and things like that. And that obviously that vision changed a great deal over the past year. But we still, you know, we had signed a lease. So we went ahead and expanded the store so we could have more room for like socially distanced browsing. And that made, you know, since we're still open to the public, that made things more accessible for people who were able to visit. And for everyone else.
Somebody needs to figure out. So we have one of our favorite shows. We had Chantal on. She just goes by Chantal. She's a celebrity mixologist. And we gave her three or four book titles. And then she custom created a cocktail for each one of the books. And she very smart. She's very literary. She's very well read. And so the drinks really made sense. I mean, they were spectacular. I think one was the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. One was Gone with the Wind. I can't remember those. But someone needs to figure out, you need to get your liquor license. And then you can package the drink that goes along with the book that you're sending out, which would be great. It'd be spectacular. So what are Boston readers into these days? And has it changed in the course of the pandemic? What are they normally into and what are they into lately?
Oh, good question, whether it's changed over the course of the pandemic. I mean, it is, I mean, funny, over the past year, people are very into classics and contemporary literature about plague and like the history of influenza.
Oh, that's so depressing. It's already depressing enough.
I know. I'm impressed that people can even watch movies about like dystopian plagues, but they are doing deep dives into the history and like sci-fi worlds of disease and contagion. That is definitely not what everyone is reading,
right?
By any means. I would say like our top things right now, well, 400 Souls, edited by Ibram X. Kendi, came out this week. That's okay. Probably been our top seller. I don't know if you're uh-huh. familiar with that one.
Heard about it.
It's a really massive effort. It's like 90 different authors, I think, in total that kind of came together right. for this. 300-year chronicle of like African American history, but it's fiction and nonfiction and poetry and I think like music and history. So they're kind of delving into this like vast span of history in every different kind of written media. It's really incredible. That's a top one. Everyone is reading the new George Saunders book. Mm-hmm. What's the title of it? Swim in a Pond in the Rain.
Right.
Which is his, he's, of course, everyone loves Lincoln and the Bardo and his short story collections. But this is kind of like his essays on Russian short stories. So you're kind of taking, he's a professor too. So you're taking like one of his fiction classes and one of his literary classes, nice. Which you would normally have to pay through the nose to do.
Yeah.
And very few people get the chance.
Do you, I felt like that listening to Simon Winchester last week. I thought I would pay to listen to this man talk. do you, when you're reading something, if you read the New York Times book review and you read a review of a book, do you go, the phone's going to be ringing off the hook tomorrow? Can you tell when something is reviewed in a certain, well, obviously positively, but if something is reviewed in a certain way, do you go, yep, our customers will want that?
Definitely the New York Times, and also if anything is on NPR, you could set your watch. It's like within the hour, people will be coming in the door.
That's so great. All right. I see, Claude, I see Lisa's box up there. Does that mean Lisa has joined us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
You're good. So nice to meet you. So we'll do weird Zoom introductions. Claude Jennings does all the important work. He's the one to be nice to. Lydia McOsker is with us from Brookline Booksmith in Boston, and Jamie McIntyre is with us as well. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I don't know if you can see, we can't see you, but if you can see us.
We're waving.
I can share video, but I'm in a dark room, so I don't know. I'll look like the sinister CI here.
Jamie looks like he's in a Stephen King novel, so.
I mean, not literally a dark room where you develop film, but a dark room.
Jamie, were you on the show when we had, there she is, when we had John Sayles?
I don't think so.
John Sayles. Okay, Lydia, please tell me. I know you don't like the Super Bowl, but please tell me you like John Sayles.
Yes.
He's incredible. And we had him on the show, and he wouldn't turn his video on. And he's a very interesting, very smart, very out of this world character. And it was just so perfect that. And I can't remember what it had, some weird word. It was something like Armageddon or something like that. It wasn't his name. It was Armageddon or something across the box.
Well, I can kind of understand, because ever since the Jeffrey Toobin incident, I've been hesitant to make sure that I check everything before I ever turn the camera on.
Okay, I promise, Lisa, we'll talk to you lots, and we'll talk to you lots about your book before she disappeared. But can I tell because we're from DC, Jamie and I can make anything about us. Yes. So I operate in lots of different worlds, the world which I grew up with Jamie McIntyre and others, and then often this horse world, and people who know nothing about this town, nothing about politics or Washington or anything, which is very healthy. And every once in a while, something would come up in the news, and someone in one of those other worlds would say to me, you know, if it's a really tough legal issue like that, maybe it's something in front of the Supreme Court or something like that, who should I pay attention to? And I would say, Supreme Court, Pete Williams, NBC, whatever he says, take it to the bank. And I said, Jeffrey Toobin, take it to the bank. I said, he is so smart. He's so solid. He knows so much. I have recommended Jeffrey Toobin to so many people. And then that happened, and I have all his books, and I thought about having him on the show. And that happened. And then I read all these other things about him, which were true and have been confirmed. And I thought, holy cow, like 20 years of recommending the guy to people. And I was so wrong. So, all right, Lisa Gardner, thanks for joining us. So many things I want to ask you about, but is it really true that you've written 23 novels so far, as well as a bunch of short works?
I've written more than 23 novels, actually.
Wow, that's a lot. Do you do anything else? Do you have any hobbies, or is it all like?
I don't know if it's good news or bad news, but I've actually been in publishing as of this year for 30 years now.
Wow. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. So yeah, it's interesting just how much the industry continues to change, and the pandemic is changing us again.
So before the pandemic, what were the biggest changes in your 30 years?
Well, I mean, the big thing has been the consolidation of publishers. And like when I first started out, it was all paperback all the time. Now it's ebooks.
Brookline Booksmith, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we've become more the wild, wild west with independent publishing, self-publishing. The industry's, you know, diversified and become decentralized in ways that are kind of exciting. And it went from being a very staid industry to, I don't think any of us can look more than 6 months ahead anymore.
Right.
But everyone still loves to read, and that's a great thing.
Yeah. My take, Jamie might have a different opinion, but my take as an amateur book person is that there's a lot more diversity because the publishing world is so, there are so many different ways to get a book out that allows a lot more diversity, a lot more experimentation, a lot more creativity than you might have if it was just a classic industry consolidated. Four big mega publishers saying we want these kinds of books because they make this much money. Is that true?
I mean, you know, I'm not the best at the overall industry look, but my sense is that, yes, you are correct. Yeah. It was very top down. Now you can really publish bottom up.
Right. Do you feel very powerful now? You get to write whatever you want to write, whenever you want to write, however you want to write it. Do you feel like you've got license to, you have more freedom now because you've written so many successful books?
I think one of the tricks for building a career in publishing is to always be writing what you like, always be writing what you're passionate about. I think that is what comes through. So I've never worried overly much about, I don't know what was hot, what was topical, things like that. Uh-huh. I've always written the kinds of books that would excite me to read. And I think that's one of the best approaches anyone can take.
All right. We have had a lot of different authors on. We've had a few, you know, Scott Turow, criminal type things, but few that have gotten as deep into the minds of criminals as you have for as long as you have. So when did this all start? When you were a kid, were you a Harriet the Spy kind of kid?
So when I was first growing up, my my family loves Perry Mason. Earl Stanley Gardner, who's like one of our first legal thriller writers.
Yeah.
Family favorite. We, in Oregon, you can still watch it noon on TV, read all the books. My 101-year-old grandmother has given me quite a collection of Earl Stanley Gardens. But yeah, it's always been a dark and stormy night and whodunit and all that kind of stuff for me. Totally.
So when you were writing short stories or fiction or whatever at an early age, were those your role models? Or did you say, I've got a different way of doing this?
No, I've always liked a puzzle. Uh-huh. And I joke, I can't write anything without a dead body. I don't know what that says about me, but there you have it. I'm a thriller author through and through.
Several of your books, I want to get the titles right. The Perfect Husband, The Survivor's Club, Hyde, At the Midnight Hour have become movies. How did you feel about that process?
It's interesting. A lot of that stuff just happens on its own. Uh-huh. But for The Hyde that aired on TNT and starred Carla Gugino, I got to go down to New Orleans and visit the set. Uh-huh. And it was really a lot of fun to see things that had only existed in my mind, you know, be turned into a set. So Hyde starts with the discovery of mummified remains in an underground pit. Uh-huh. So they actually built it. So
they built the underground pit.
Yeah. They had to create, I mean, as an entire structure. And then the set designer had to make it look creepy. So he'd actually like nailed baby dolls to the walls of the pit. Even I'm like walking through this thing going, this is like beyond creepy. The makeup artist wouldn't even go in there. If you wanted your makeup touched out, you had to come out and find her.
Have you mostly liked the way they have done things with the movies? Did they look the way you imagined them?
I really enjoyed Hyde on TNT, and I thought the cast did a really great job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's different. A book's 100,000 words. A movie script is 40,000 words. So it's going to be its own creative process project.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let's talk a lot about Before She Disappeared. I'm saying, I think at the start of the show. So I picked it up about a week ago. I've had it for a couple of weeks, but I picked it about a week ago. And I started reading going, okay. I think I know where this is going to go. Of course I didn't, because there are so many twists and turns. And I'm going to try really hard on this show not to give away too many things, because you think you know what's going to happen. And then you have this, I didn't see that coming moment. The lamp, for God's sake, I'll just throw out cues that people can come up with the lamp. Tell us about the process. Do you plot all of that in advance, or does it just kind of happen?
So Before She Disappeared starts the same way most of my books do, which is it is inspired by something I read in the real world. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I mean, I kind of just go with it from there. So in this case, I'd read a story about a real person, a real life woman. And this is what she does. She was growing frustrated by the number of women that were going missing on tribal lands. Felt there was a lack of resources, but also just a lack of interest in doing anything about it. So she's an everyday person, and she decided she'd try to work some of the cases, and it has evolved now. And this is what she does full time.
Now this is this is where Jamie asked your favorite question on the show.
Usually at this point, I ask, you know, so what is the book about exactly? But what you just said, jogged memory, is this, when you say it was inspired by a real life event, is this the woman Lissa Yellowbird who was heard on This American Life episode a few months back?
Yeah, and I read about her on BBC. She's been in several things. Yes, Lissa Yellowbird Chase.
Okay, yeah, so because she was, you know, when you were saying this, I was thinking, oh yeah, I've heard a story like this, and I remember now. It was an episode of This American Life. But so we've talked all around the book, but we haven't told anybody what's the central plot of the book.
Okay. So Before She Disappeared, inspired by a real life woman that looks for cold cases, and that brings us to the book where my inspired heroine, Frankie Elkin, who is a recovering alcoholic, as she likes to put it, she's short on belongings and long on regret. This is what she does now. She goes from town to town, and she is looking for the missing persons the world has forgotten. So in this case, she's come to Mattapan, Boston, an inner city neighborhood, where a 15-year-old Haitian girl has been missing for 11 months. Left school like 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, never been seen since. And Frankie is now on the case. Again, she's not a private investigator. She's not a detective. She's just an everyday average person. She's actually a professional bartender, is really her occupation.
Which is my dream job. I was very envious of Frankie reading the book. Like, that's exactly what I want to be doing. Let me ask Lydia a quick question. Lydia from Brookline Booksmith. So this is, as are many of Lisa Gardner's book, based in Boston. It is Mattapan, a community in Boston, Haitian community in Boston. When a book like this comes out, and Lisa, am I right? It's already hit the New York Times bestseller list. It's been out just for a handful of days. But when people in Boston hear about this great book that's based in Boston, will that cause them to pick up the phone and come in and come to your ice cream window and say, we want that? Do they like local?
Definitely. I think they love local. It's half loving a local story and half like kind of wanting to catch the author out again.
Oh,
dear. It's
a vindictive love.
Okay. That race. So it is, I'm going to turn it back over to Lisa in just a minute, but Lisa, there's so much about the Haitian community. There's so much about food. What was the research like that you did for this? Because it sounds like you've lived in that neighborhood for 1,000 years.
I have not lived in Mattapan, but I've lived in Boston. Mm-hmm. Before I set a book someplace, I like to go there. So I took some time. I'd done a bunch of research, and then I came into Mattapan. I wandered the streets so I could get some of the locations and setting right. I always feel like a great setting, particularly a city neighborhood, it's like a character itself. So it was interesting to read about Mattapan and have outsiders' impressions. Mm-hmm. And then it was like meeting Mattapan myself and realizing, there are some neighborhoods and blocks that were gorgeous. The parks are amazing. But then you'd also walk through sections where you're like, okay, this is I'm a little nervous now. Mm-hmm. This is feeling, you know, a tad on the dangerous side. And then I got to eat Haitian food. And I love to travel and eat, and any opportunity to try something new. Oh my gosh, it was so much fun.
I wondered, Frankie, the heroine of the story, who's just an amazing character, loves the food, is introduced to the food, loves the coffee, consumes a lot of the coffee. Are you a big coffee drinker?
I was in my younger days. I've become more tea now. But Dunkin' Donuts coffee is a classic. You can't write New England and not have.
Exactly. Okay. So again, I'm going to try so hard to talk about this book, which is called Before She Disappeared. Everyone should get it without giving things away. But you really get into the hearts and minds and souls of your characters. There's Frankie, the recovering alcoholic who goes looking for people who have disappeared and no one cares about. There's Angelique, not giving anything away, the girl who's gone missing. There's her brother, Emmanuel. There's a great detective. And not everything is wonderful. Is it hard? I don't know if you fall in love with your characters, but is it hard for you when bad things happen to them? Do you find yourself protecting some of them? Because I found myself wanting to protect some people as I was reading the story.
I'm a character-based author. The characters kind of come to me. I feel like sometimes it's like a personal narrative from Frankie that also happens to have this crime story going on. Because I don't plot, because I'm kind of learning as I go and discovering, one of the central questions of before she disappeared, other than what happened to this 15-year-old girl and how does anyone disappear in a crowded urban environment, but what kind of woman walks away from a quote unquote normal life, you know, a stable job, a house, a long-term relationship to roll from town to town, searching for people she's never met. And, you know, that was inspired by the real world case of Lisa Yellowbird Chase. And I somewhat wrote the whole book trying to answer that question. Who is Frankie and why is she doing this? So I wasn't necessarily protecting her as much as I was just seeing where she would take me.
Yeah. So that was the driving force.
Yeah.
That made the plot happen. So a couple of months ago, we had Ken Follett on, who takes 3 years.
Oh, I love him. Yes.
He was also a fabulous guest. Total pro. He takes 3 years to write a book now. And he has spreadsheets and index cards on every single person. And he has some program now to keep him from making mistakes and contradicting something he said in the first 300 pages, those kinds of things. Is there a whiteboard in your house where you write and you map these things out? Or is it just flow?
As I develop details, particularly with Frankie's character, with the other characters, I do document them. Uh-huh. In the beginning of my career, I did not, and it did come back to haunt me.
The readers caught on to something.
You know, when they do a movie, they often screen test the movie for the ending to see how it plays with the audiences. And sometimes if it doesn't play well, they change the ending. Do you know when you start on page one, how it's going to end? And does that ever change?
No, I never know how it's going to end. I don't know who did it. I don't know where I'm going with it. I do not plot. And I kind of like it because, again, I think you introduce a large cast of people. They all have strengths. They all have weaknesses. And if you make them real and complicated, well, then anyone could be the bad guy. And anyone could be the hero, too, for that matter. You kind of have it just built in by the fact that they're all human.
So when we get to the end and it's revealed, you're as surprised as anyone.
That's great.
When I first started out, when I was a new writer and I was nervous, I did plot because I had to know what I was going to write to show up to work that day. But what I found was it felt to me at the end of the day, it was very linear. Because, you know, in one day, basically outlined a whole book. It kind of becomes A to B to C to D. It gets a little flat. Yeah. Whereas if you spend 6 months developing a plot and you don't know where it's going, well, I can't broadcast it to the reader. And when readers say, I was so surprised by the ending, I'm like, great, me too.
Let me ask you, do you have a sense of your customers? Do they like a surprise ending, a happy ending? A sad ending? The pandemic stuff they're already notwithstanding, but normally.
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like the happy ending lovers, they're not seeking out the mystery thriller genre for the most part.
Yeah.
They're in the romance section right across the aisle. But I think everyone loves a surprise ending when it's satisfying. You know, if you're not like left in the dark, with unanswered questions, then a surprise is just the kind of the best final course.
Yeah.
So Lisa, in a thriller novel, you have to have closure. It should be a surprise, but it should make sense. I mean, I think there is a contract with the reader that you're going to solve the crime and you want to make it unexpected, but you also want it to be, they had a fighting chance at figuring it out too. Like, it's not like so out of left field that they're kind of like, well, okay, well, if it was the butler with the candlestick, I didn't even know there's a butler in the book. I mean, there are some kind of like, you know, contracts with the reader you want to honor.
I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing. reading the book before she disappeared, I was tempted to go to the end of the book. And I had to stop myself and go, no, go stay with this and figure it out when everybody else figures out. But I bet there'd be a fair number of people did that. So let's talk about the police. Police have been a big part of your life for a long time, Lisa Gardner. And I can only imagine how much they must hate amateur sleuths who come into their neighborhoods, come into their communities and say, I'm going to figure this out. You knuckleheads eating donuts couldn't figure this out, but I'm going to figure this out. Is this something you learned from the work and the research you've done over the years with the police, this particular aspect?
Well, yes. And this was one of the interesting things, too, when you read about Lisa Oliver Chase is, yeah, police do not want any kind of, you know, professional bartender right. coming in to find the like work an active police investigation. The families, too, often have issues. I mean, we sure. know in crime, the families are often among the first suspects, particularly in missing persons. There might be secrets and stuff in the family. So it's such a high conflict thing to do where you're not getting compensated. I mean, it's not clear, again, what the reward is. It's a contract, really, with the victim. And that's how mm-hmm. Frankie feels.
Yeah.
She is going to piss off the police. She is going to piss off the family. Her contract is with the missing girl, Angelique. And again, it gets back to that question of who would do this to themselves? I mean, this mm-hmm. is not an easy life.
Right.
This is not an easy road to hoe.
And again, not wanting to give anything away, I personally think there's a very strong reason and motivation Frankie does this.
Yeah.
Why she's doing exactly that, not other things, which is great. Who would play Frankie in the movie? Who's going to play Frankie in the TV movie that I'm sure someone or a bigger movie someone will make of it?
It'll be fun to find out.
Someone, I don't know. Hey, so Jamie, before your Pentagon days, when I got to know you, you covered a lot of local news in Washington, D.C., right?
Yes, I was a local news reporter for WTOP Radio.
How did the local police feel about local radio reporters back then?
Well, so I spent a year on the 4 to midnight shift where you would just go out. I would drive around in my Reliant K car with a bunch of antennas sticking out of it and 3 police scanners in the car. And I would just wait for something to happen. And then I would rush to the scene. And sometimes I would even get there before the police. But they were pretty good. You know, they DC police issued press credentials. They knew, you know, if you're on the night beat, they knew you're a reporter. Back then, I used to dress a little more professional than I did later in my career, because I was taking it more seriously. But I used to have one of those, you know, I don't know, M60 CBS official reporter correspondent trench coats.
Oh, nice! With the belts that you wrapped around?
Nice!
Very nice. Like McGruff the crime dog. Let's keep it on the crime theme.
Exactly, yeah. Like McGruff the crime dog.
By the way, I always thought McGruff was a little creepy looking. Just a little...
So I remember one night I'd rushed to a scene and I also had the 2-way radio because we didn't have cell phones back then.
But
I had one of those big Motorola 2-way radios and had my tape recorder and my trench coat. And I remember one time I was coming back from a crime scene and I stopped at the Burger King on the corner of Connecticut Avenue in Albemarle. I don't know if it's still.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally still there.
And I went in and I ordered the, the Whopper, you know, uh-huh. I get, and I had some fries. It's like, you know, 11 o'clock at night, I'm about to get off and I'm going to pay for it. And they said, no, you don't have to pay. I said, no.
Oh, nice.
I said, no, you don't have to pay. They thought I was a cop.
Nice.
Yeah.
And the cops, they didn't charge the cops. So anyway.
That's awesome.
But
okay.
We had a good relationship with the police. I never had any problem.
Good. Lisa, you like them, obviously.
Yes.
I say obviously, maybe not obviously, but you seem to have developed a very knowledgeable relationship with police.
You know, it's always different. Every book I've done, I've called different experts. I've researched different things. It was interesting to write before she disappeared because it's my first novel where it is an amateur sleuth. It is the main character. It's not, law enforcement,
right.
Not FBI.
Not a pro.
And yet still, I mean, it's a cold case. So you do still have to start by talking to the police. I mean, if a 15-year-old girl went missing in Mattapan, what would your procedure be? And it was interesting to me because, like I said, I don't plan too far ahead. So I was kind of worried when I was writing before she disappeared, how are we going to find Angelique Boudot, the missing girl? And really, after talking to the police and the amount of surveillance, cameras, license plate reading technology, witnesses, cell phones, social media that they can use to track a teenager, the real question became, how did she ever disappear in the first place? And I wrote 200 pages without knowing the answer to that question.
That's very brave. It sounds very brave to write, to commit 200 pages and not know how it's going to end up.
You know, it always works out. It's like that leap of faith. What's a Shakespeare in Love? Jeffrey Rush's character is like, it's a mess. It's a last minute. It's a crisis, but it always works out.
It always works out. I want to talk about your website for a minute because, and again, raving about Simon Winchester. Simon Winchester has a fabulous website. Your website is fabulous, partly because it's beautiful and it's clean and it's easy to navigate, but you have a toolbox for aspiring writers.
Yes.
And it's really well done. Some authors have the FAQs, like, you know, how to become a writer. Don't contact me. Don't email me. I can't respond. That's essentially how most of them do it. But yours offers very useful tutorials on different aspects of writing. And you're a research geek. You're a self-described research geek.
Yeah.
And here's what I want to get to. You talk about how to research. And then the next section is don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Don't overdo the research. Why?
Well, you know, I think it was Hemingway who had that quote. You have to learn about the iceberg only to write about the tip. I mean, you want to educate. Part of before she disappeared is how does anyone disappear in this day and age? And also, you know, these gaps in law enforcement or justice system or someone who is like a 15-year-old immigrant is going to fall through the cracks and maybe not get the kind of attention someone else would. But at the end of the day, a thriller's job is to entertain. It is to be compelling and clever and fast paced. And you don't want to be force feeding your readers, you know, too much information. It should be organic. And I can only do that by, I joke, I'm the Goldilocks reader. The first draft is too much. The second draft has too little. And then the third draft is just right.
So let me ask you. So not to promote other podcasts, but one of the podcasts I listen to is The Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
Okay.
It says fun facts to know and tell about authors. And in this morning's podcast, he was talking about the fact that it was the birthday of John Grisham and that his first novel, A Time to Kill, in 1989, wasn't all that successful. And this is what Garrison Keillor said. He said, Grisham read Writer's Digest magazine and found an article about the rules of suspense and used that formula to write a thriller about a law student who realizes the firm he works for is connected to the mafia. That, of course, was The Firm.
Yeah.
So, but he doesn't tell us, what are these rules of suspense that Grisham might have found in the Writer's Digest? Any idea?
I mean, I have what I consider the rules of suspense. One, you know, the who did it should be someone that you have introduced as a cast of character. There should be enough foreshadowing or realistic clues that, again, the reader has a fighting shot at figuring it out because, you know, people like to play armchair detective when they read. My first editor made a big deal about the police should never be stupid. That's not clever. It shouldn't be that the protagonist just missed something obvious and that's why they didn't catch the person. And I've always agreed with that. I don't think that's a very good suspense. The bad guy the villains should have a moral code so that they are not plastic. You don't want like the cackling villain on the sideline kind of thing. So there's things like that, that definitely I do think most thrillers, you want the crime itself to be solved. Things can go on with characters. You can have some like carryover from that, but people are reading for closure. Yeah. I mean, they want to at the last page, know what happened.
On your fabulous website, in your toolbox, you say the villain developing the diabolical prima donna, give the villain something worth fighting for.
Yeah.
Which is so great. I mean, they need motivation too. Right. And it's not
exactly.
They're not all abhorrent, terrible creatures all the way through.
Yeah, one of the terms we use often in writing is goal, motivation, and conflict. In both the protagonist and the antagonist, they should have goals, they should have motivation, and they should have conflict. And if you do that, people will follow the book. It is interesting.
That's great. What's next? We'll get you out with this. What's next? As someone who
I actually
spent a lot of time on planes and have read a lot of your books, we need more.
Thank you. I am working on the next book with Frankie Elkin. This time she is in national public lands where a lot of people also go missing. And we don't even have a centralized database. We don't even know within this country how many people go missing. And she goes into the woods and a lot of murder and mayhem ensue.
And will you go out to these parts of the world and spend time there?
Well, the pandemic is clipping my wings. I'm an avid hiker where I live. And I live in the mountains of New Hampshire. We have quite a bit of national public land. So at least I'm able to use that as a starting point.
Great. Awesome. Okay. I've got a little bit of housekeeping. And then we're going to have a little deserted island. Jamie's familiar with deserted island. Lydia less so. Lisa, not at all, but it'll be really easy. So just stay with us because that's how we end up.
Okay.
So the housekeeping is this. Everybody download us wherever you listen to podcasts. Review us if you're thinking nice things. Send your emails to info@chatteronbooks.com. Please let me know if I can use your name or not. That's a big deal. And come back next week when we have Rebecca Sachs. She is a first-time novelist who has written a really, really remarkable book, City of 1,000 Gates, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's getting really interesting buzz from a lot of different places, including a lot of Middle East scholars who say this is a great way to approach it, to tackle this. So Deserted Island, it's all queens all the time today. On this day, February 8th, which is when we're taping the show, Mary Queen of Scots was beheaded in 1587 for treason, and Princess Elizabeth, formerly Princess Elizabeth, became queen in 1952. So in honor of all things royal, do you have any favorite books about royals? Lydia, I'm just guessing. You don't watch the Super Bowl. I'm guessing not, but do you have any favorites?
I absolutely do. I highly recommend The Romanovs by Simon Bag Montefiore. Are you familiar?
Yeah. Yes, fabulous. Fabulous.
History of Russia through the 300-year reign of this one royal family. And it's just, it's gruesome and salacious and it's so good.
Yeah, it's fabulous. That's what. Why is that not a miniseries of some type?
Oh, I mean, the clock's ticking.
Yeah, exactly. Jamie?
Okay, so this is just so unfair because you should have asked me first. So I thought about this today and I couldn't come up. So I asked my wife, Roberta, who's better read than I am.
Right.
Not only has she read more books, but she's read more all the way to the end. I have this habit of reading them and then putting them down and then going on.
Because you know the ending. You figured out.
I said, so I have to come up with a book about royalty. And so she mentioned one of her favorites, which was Nicholas and Alexandra.
Wow.
Robert K. Massey, which a long time ago. It's about, of course, the last of the Romanovs.
It's fabulous,
and,
too.
And it's, and you know, what's the chances you'd have two books about the Romanovs? Now I feel like I should pull another answer out of the air, like maybe, I don't know, the Prince.
No, I think that says something. And I don't think that's the first go-to for most people in royal, so I think that's good. Well, mine's very typical. Anything by Hilary Mantel about the Tudors, so Wolf Hall and that trilogy, which is just fabulous. And they're so good. And there have been some great binge-worthy series that I can't even separate them from one from the other because they're so good. And Lisa, I don't know if Lisa's still with us.
I have the counter royal. Grace O'Malley was the pirate queen. Ooh. And was a Queen Elizabeth I's nemesis during like the 19th century. In fact, Queen Elizabeth had her in the Tower of London twice.
Wow. But
the two were the only real female rulers of the time. And Grace O'Malley was basically, was kind of keeping parts of Ireland together.
Huh.
And she's fabulous to read about. And this whole dynamic between her and Elizabeth I, who in their own interesting ways, they were each other's peer. But I mean, clearly Grace O'Malley was plundering all the British ships and, you know, helping using the money from that to help the Irish stand up against the English.
Oh, it's a fabulous recommendation. I love those. All right, everybody. This is Lisa Gardner. Thank you so much for being with us. Really just an absolute pleasure. Everyone should get Before She Disappeared. Hopefully get it at your favorite local independent bookstore like Brookline Booksmiths. And if you can't do your favorite local independent bookstore, do bookshop.org. If you want to listen to it, do Libra.fm because that gets some of the proceeds to the independent bookstores, which we try to support. Lydia Begosker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
you. Non-sports fan that you are, we love having you with us. Hope we get to do something with you again. Jamie, thank you very much, my friend. Hope you're feeling better.
I'm a little bit. Can I just mention one thing?
Of course.
In case our listener, again, not to promote other podcasts, but in case anyone wants to go back and listen to the very excellent This American Life episode that inspired the book, it's called A Mess to Be Reckoned With. I just looked it up, and it ran back in May, but it's available on their website for free. You can download and listen to it and see what the inspiration was for the book.
Awesome.
Neat.
Thank you very much. That is very neat. Lisa, thank you. Claude, thank you for doing all the important work. Everybody come back next week. In the meantime, wear a mask, wash your hands, and stay safe.